plant. One of the vases, top-heavy with flowers, fell over with a crash. Someone screamed. It was Rachel, struggling with her mother, who was trying to hold her back. The people who were there, 10 or 15 in all, seemed frozen between fright and embarrassment. Steve had taken Judd back to Ludlow, and Lewis was dimly grateful for that. This was not a scene he would have wished Judd to witness. It was unseemly.
"Don't hurt him," Rachel screamed. "Lewis, don't hurt my father."
"You like to hit old men, do you?"
Erwin Goldman of the overflowing checkbook cried out shrilly. He was grinning through a mouthful of blood.
"You like to hit old men? I am not surprised, you stinking bastard."
"That does not surprise me at all."
Lewis turned toward him, and Goldman struck him in the neck. It was a clumsy, side-handed, chopping blow, but Lewis was unprepared for it. A paralyzing pain that would make it hard for him to swallow for the next 2 hours exploded in his throat. His head rocked back, and he fell to one knee in the aisle.
"First the flowers, now me," he thought. "What is it the Ramones say? Hey, ho, let's go."
He thought he wanted to laugh, but there was no laugh in him. What came out of his hurt throat was a little groan. Rachel screamed again. Erwin Goldman, his mouth dripping blood, marched over to where his son-in-law kneeled and kicked Lewis smartly in the kidneys. The pain was a bright flare of agony. He put his hands down on the rug runner to keep from going flop on his belly.
"You don't do so good even against old men, sonny,"
Goldman cried with cracked excitement. He kicked out at Lewis again, missing the kidney this time, getting Lewis on the high part of the left buttock with one black old man's shoe. Lewis grunted in pain, and this time he did go down on the carpet. His chin hit with an audible crack. He bit his tongue.
"There,"
Goldman cried.
"There's the kick in the ass I should have given you the first time you came sucking around, you bastard. There."
He kicked Lewis in the ass again, this time connecting with the other buttock. He was weeping and grinning. Lewis saw for the first time that Goldman was unshaven, a sign of mourning. The funeral director raced toward them. Rachel had broken Mrs. Goldman's hold and was also racing toward them, screaming. Lewis rolled clumsily over on his side and sat up. His father-in-law kicked out at him again, and Lewis caught his shoe in both hands. It thwopped solidly into his palms like a well-caught football, and shoved backward as hard as he could. Bellowing, Goldman flew backward at an angle, pinwheeling his arms for balance. He fell on Gage's eternal rest casket, which had been manufactured in the town of Storyville, Ohio, and which had not come cheap.
"Oz the Great and Terrible has just fallen on top of my son's coffin," Lewis thought dazedly. The casket fell from the trestle with a huge crash. The left end fell first, then the right. The latch snapped. Even over the screams and the crying, even over the bellows of Goldman, who, after all, was only playing a children's party game of pin the blame on the donkey, Lewis heard the lock snap. The coffin did not actually open and spill Gage's sad, hurt remains out onto the floor for all of them to gawp at. But Lewis was sickly aware that they had only been spared that by the way the coffin had fallen, on its bottom instead of on its side. It easily could have fallen that other way. Nonetheless, in that split instant before the lid slammed shut on its broken latch again, he saw a flash of gray, the suit they had bought to put in the ground around Gage's body, and a bit of pink. Gage's hand, maybe. Sitting there on the floor, Lewis put his face in his hands and began to weep. He had lost all interest in his father-in-law, in the MX missile, in permanent versus dissolving sutures, in the heat death of the universe. At that moment, Lewis Creed wished he were dead. And suddenly, weirdly, an image rose in his mind. Gage, in Mickey Mouse ears. Gage laughing and shaking hands with a great big Goofy on Main Street. In Disney World, he saw this with utter clarity. One of the trestle supports had fallen over.
The other leaned with drunken casualness against the low dais where a minister might stand to offer a eulogy. Sprawled in the flowers was Goldman, also weeping. Water from the overturned vases trickled. The flowers, some of them crushed and mangled, gave off their turgid scent even more strongly. Rachel was screaming and screaming. Lewis could not respond to her screams. The image of Gage and Mickey Mouse ears was fading, but not before he heard a voice announcing there would be fireworks later that evening. He sat with his face in his hands, not wanting them to see him anymore, his tear-stained face, his loss, his guilt, his pain, his shame, most of all his cowardly wish to be dead and out of this blackness. The funeral director and Dory Goldman led Rachel out. She was still screaming. Later on, in another room, one that Lewis assumed was reserved especially for those overcome with grief, the hysterics parlor, perhaps, she became very silent. Lewis himself, dazed but sane and in control, sedated her this time, after insisting that the two of them be left alone. At home, he led her up to bed and gave her another shot. Then he pulled the covers up to her chin and regarded her waxy, pallid face. "Rachel, I'm sorry," he said. "I'd give anything in the world to take that back."
"It's all right,"
she said in a strange, flat voice, and then rolled over on her side, turning away from him. He heard the tired old question, "Are you all right?" rising to his lips and pushed it back. It wasn't a true question. It wasn't what he really wanted to know. "How bad are you?" he asked finally.
"Pretty bad, Lewis," she said, and then uttered a sound that could have been a laugh. "I am terrible, in fact."
Something more seemed required, but Lewis could not supply it. He felt suddenly resentful of her, of Steve Masterton, of Missy Dandridge and her husband with his arrow-shaped Adam's apple, of the whole damned crew. Why should he have to be the eternal supplier? What sort of shit was that? He turned off the light and left. He found that he could not give much more to his daughter. For one wild moment, regarding her in her shadowy room, he thought she was Gage. The thought came to him that the whole thing had been a hideous nightmare, like his dream of Pascal leading him into the woods. And for a moment, his tired mind grasped at it. The shadows helped. There was only the shifting light of the portable TV that Judd had taken up for her to pass the hours. The long, long hours. But it wasn't Gage, of course. It was Ellie, who was now not only grasping the picture in which she was pulling Gage on the sled, but sitting in Gage's chair. She had taken it out of his room and brought it into hers. It was a small director's chair with a canvas seat and a canvas strip across the back. Stenciled across that strip was Gage. Rachel had mail-ordered four of these chairs. Each member of the family had one, with his or her name stenciled on the back. Ellie was too big for Gage's chair. She was crammed into it, and the canvas bottom bulged downward dangerously. She held the Polaroid picture to her chest and stared at the TV, where some movie was showing. "Ellie," he said, snapping off the TV. "Bedtime." She worked her way out of the chair, then folded it up. She apparently meant to take the chair into bed with her. Lewis hesitated, wanting to say something about the chair, and finally settled on, "Do you want me to tuck you in?"
"Yes, please," she said.
Would you want to sleep with Mommy tonight?"
"No, thanks."
"You sure?" She smiled a little.
"Yes. She steals the covers."
Lewis smiled back. "Come on, then." Instead of trying to put the chair in bed with her, Ellie unfolded it by the head of the bed, and an absurd image came to Lewis. Here was the consulting room of the world's smallest psychiatrist. She undressed, putting the picture of her and Gage on her pillow to do it. She put on her baby doll pajamas,
picked up the picture, went into the bathroom, put it down to wash up, brush, floss, and to take her fluoride tablet. Then she picked it up again and got into bed with it. Lewis sat down beside her and said, "I want you to know, Ellie, that if we keep on loving each other, we can get through this." Each word was like moving a handcar loaded with wet bales, and the total effort left Lewis feeling exhausted.
"I'm going to wish really hard," Ellie said calmly, "and pray to God for Gage to come back."
"Ellie, God can take it back if he wants to," Ellie said.
"He can do anything he wants to."
"Ellie, God doesn't do things like that," Lewis said uneasily. And in his mind's eye, he saw Church, squatting on the closed lid of the toilet, staring at him with those muddy eyes as Lewis lay in the tub.
"He does so," she said. "In Sunday school, the teacher told us about this guy Lazarus. He was dead, and Jesus brought him back to life. He said, 'Lazarus, come forth.' And the teacher said if he just said, 'Come forth,' probably everybody in that graveyard would have come out, and Jesus only wanted Lazarus."
An absurdity popped out of his mouth, but the day had sung and gibbered with absurdity. "That was a long time ago, Ellie."
"I'm going to keep things ready for him," she said. "I've got his picture, and I'm going to sit in his chair."
"Ellie, you're too big for Gage's chair," Lewis said, taking her hot, feverish hand. "You'll break it."
"God will help it not to break,"
Ellie said. Her voice was serene, but Lewis observed the brown half-moons under her eyes. Looking at her made his heart ache so badly that he turned away from her. Maybe when Gage's chair broke, she would begin to understand what had happened a little better.
"I'm going to carry the picture and sit in his chair," she said. "I'm going to eat his breakfast, too."
Gage and Ellie had each had their own breakfast cereals. Gage's, Ellie had once claimed, tasted like dead boogers. If Cocoa Bears was the only cereal in the house, Ellie would sometimes eat a boiled egg, or nothing at all.
"I'll eat lima beans, even though I hate them, and I'll read all of Gage's picture books, and I'll get things ready, in case."
She was crying now. Lewis did not try to comfort her, but only brushed her hair back from her forehead. What she was talking about made a certain crazed sense. Keeping the lines open, keeping things current, keeping Gage in the present, in the hot 100, refusing to let him recede. "Remember when Gage did this or that?"
"Yeah, that was great. Good old Gage, what a kid."
When it started not to hurt, it started not to matter. She understood, perhaps, Lewis thought, how easy it would be to let Gage be dead.
"Ellie, don't cry anymore," he said. "This isn't forever."
She cried forever. For 15 minutes. She actually fell asleep before her tears stopped, but eventually she slept, and downstairs the clock struck 10 in the quiet house.
"Keep him alive, Ellie, if that's what you want," he thought and kissed her. "The shrinks would probably say it's as unhealthy as hell, but I'm for it. Because I know the day will come, maybe as soon as this Friday, when you forget to carry the picture, and I'll see it lying on your bed in this empty room, while you ride your bike around the driveway, or walk in the field behind the house, or go over to Kathy McGowan's house to make clothes with her so perfect. Gage won't be with you, and that's when Gage drops off whatever hot 100 there is that exists in little girls' hearts and starts to become something that happened in 1984. A blast from the past." Lewis left the room and stood for a moment at the head of the stairs, thinking, not seriously, about going to bed. He knew what he needed, and went downstairs to get it. Lewis Albert Creed set methodically about getting drunk. Downstairs in the cellar were 5 cases of Schlitz light beer. Lewis drank beer, Judd drank it, Steve Masterton drank it. Missy Dandridge would occasionally have a beer or two while watching the kids. "Kid," Lewis reminded himself, going down the cellar stairs. Even Charlton,
on the few occasions she had come over to the house, preferred a beer, as long as it was a light beer, to a glass of wine. So one day last winter, Rachel had gone out and bought a staggering 10 cases when Schlitz Light went on sale at the brewer A&P. "Stop you running down to Julio's in Orrington every time somebody drops in," she had said. "And you're always quoting Robert Parker to me, love. Any beer that's in the refrigerator after the stores close is good beer, right? So drink this and think about the dough you're saving." Last winter, when things had been okay. When things had been okay. It was funny how quickly and easily your mind made that crucial division. Lewis brought up a case of beer and shoved the cans into the fridge. Then he took one can, closed the fridge door, and opened the beer. Church came oiling slowly and rustily out of the pantry at the sound of the refrigerator door, and stared inquiringly up at Lewis. The cat did not come too close. Lewis had perhaps kicked it too many times. "Nothing for you," he told the cat. "You had your can of Kahlo today. If you want something else, go kill a bird." Church stood there, looking up at him. Lewis drank off half the can of beer and felt it go to his head almost at once. "You don't even eat them, do you?" he asked. "Just killing them is enough for you." Church strolled into the living room, apparently deciding there was going to be no food. And after a moment, Lewis followed it. He thought again, randomly. "Hey-ho, let's go." Lewis sat down in his chair and looked at Church again. The cat was reclining on the rug by the TV stand, watching Lewis carefully, probably ready to run if Lewis should suddenly become aggressive and decide to put his kicking foot in gear. Instead, Lewis raised his beer. "To Gage," he said. "To my son, who might have been an artist or an Olympic swimmer or the motherfucking president of the United States. What do you say, asshole?" Church regarded him with those dull, strange eyes. Lewis drank off the rest of his beer in big gulps that hurt his tender throat, arose, went to the fridge, and got a second one. By the time Lewis had finished 3 beers, he felt that he had some sort of equilibrium for the first time that day. By the time he had gotten through the first 6-pack, he felt that sleep might actually be possible in another hour or so. He came back from the fridge with his 8th or 9th. He had really lost count by then and was walking on a slant. And his eyes fell on Church. The cat was dozing, or pretending to, on the rug now. The thought came so naturally that it surely must have been there all along, simply waiting its time to come forward from the back of his mind. "When are you going to do it? When are you going to bury Gage in the annex to the pet cemetery?" And on the heels of that, "Lazarus, come forth!" Ellie's sleepy, dazed voice. "The teacher said if he just said, come forth, probably everybody in that graveyard would have come out." A chill of such elemental force struck him that Lewis clutched himself as the shudder twisted through his body. He suddenly found himself remembering Ellie's first day of school, how Gage had gone to sleep on his lap while he and Rachel were listening to Ellie prattle on about old MacDonald and Mrs. Berryman. He had said, "Just let me put the baby to bed." And when he took Gage upstairs, a horrible premonition had struck him. And now he understood. Back in September, part of him had known Gage was going to die soon. Part of him had known that Oz the Great and Terrible was at hand. It was nonsense. It was rot. It was superstitious bullshit of the purest ray serene. And it was true. He had known. Lewis spilled some of his beer on his shirt, and Church looked up wearily to see if this was a signal that the evening's cat-kicking festivities were about to commence. Lewis suddenly remembered the question he had asked Judd. He remembered the way Judd's arm had jerked, knocking 2 empty beer bottles off the table. One of them had shattered. "You don't even want to talk about such things, Lewis." But he did want to talk about them, or at least think about them. The pet cemetery. What was beyond the pet cemetery? The idea had a deadly attraction. It made a balance of logic which was impossible to deny. Church had been killed in the road.
Gage had been killed in the road. Here was Church, changed, of course, distasteful in some ways, but here. Ellie, Gage, and Rachel all had a working relationship with him. He killed birds, true, and had turned a few mice inside out, but killing small animals was a cat thing to do. Church had by no means turned into Franken-cat. He was, in many ways, as good as ever.
"You're rationalizing," a voice whispered. "He's not as good as ever. He's spooky. The crow, Lewis. Remember the crow?"
"Good God," Lewis said aloud in a shaky, distracted voice he was barely able to recognize as his own. "God, oh yes, fine, sure. If there had ever been a time to invoke the name of God outside of a novel about ghosts or vampires, this was it."
So just what in the name of God was he thinking about?
He was thinking about a dark blasphemy, which he was even now not wholly able to credit. Worse, he was telling himself lies, not just rationalizing, but outright lying.
"So what's the truth? You want the truth so fucking bad? What's the truth?"
"That Church wasn't really a cat anymore at all. Start with that. He looked like a cat and he acted like a cat, but he was really only a poor imitation. People couldn't actually see through that imitation, but they could feel through it." He remembered a night when Charlton had been at the house. The occasion had been a small pre-Christmas dinner party. They'd been sitting in there talking after the meal, and Church had jumped up in her lap. Charlton had pushed the cat off immediately, a quick and instinctive moo of distaste puckering her mouth. It had been no big deal. No one had even commented on it, but it was there. Charlton had felt what the cat wasn't. Lewis killed his beer and went back for another. If Gage came back changed in such a way, that would be an obscenity. He popped the top and drank deeply. He was drunk now, drunk for fair, and there would be a big head for him to deal with tomorrow. "How I Went to My Son's Funeral with a Hangover" by Lewis Creed, author of "How I Just Missed Him at the Crucial Moment," and numerous other works. Drunk, sure. And he suspected now that the reason he had gotten drunk was so he could consider this crazy idea soberly. In spite of everything, the idea had that deadly attraction, that sick luster, that glamour. Yes, that above all else. It had glamour. Judd was back, speaking in his mind.
"You do it because it gets hold of you. You do it because that burial place is a secret place, and you want to share the secret. You make up reasons. They seem like good reasons. Mostly you do it because you want to, or because you have to."
Judd's voice, low and drawling with Yankee intonation. Judd's voice chilling his flesh, bringing out the goosebumps, making the hackles on the back of his neck rise.
"These are secret things, Lewis. The soil of a man's heart is stonier, like the soil up in the old Micmac burying ground. A man grows what he can, and he tends it."
Lewis began to go over the other things Judd had told him about the Micmac burying ground. He began to collate the data, to sort through it, to compress it. He proceeded in exactly the same way he had once readied himself for big exams. The dog. Spot.
"I could see all the places where the barbed wire had hooked him. There was no fur in any of those places, and the flesh looked dimpled in."
The bull. Another file turned over in Lewis's mind.
"Lester Morgan buried his prize bull up there. Black Angus bull, named Hanratty. Lester dragged him all the way up there on a sledge. Shot him dead 2 weeks later. That bull turned mean. Really mean. But he's the only animal I ever heard of that did."
"He turned mean. The soil of a man's heart is stonier. He turned really mean.
He's the only animal I ever heard of that did. Mostly you do it because once you've been up there, it's your place."
The flesh looked dimpled in. Panratty, ain't that a silly name for a bull? A man grows what he can and tends it. They're my rats and my birds. I bought the fuckers. It's your place, a secret place, and it belongs to you, and you belong to it. He turned mean, but he's the only animal I ever heard of that did. What do you want to buy next, Lewis? When the wind blows hard at night and the moon lays a white path through the woods to that place? Want to climb those stairs again? When they're watching a horror movie, everyone in the audience knows the hero or the heroine is stupid to go up those stairs. But in real life, they always do. They smoke. They don't wear seat belts. They move their family in beside a busy highway where the big rigs drone back and forth all day and all night. So, Lewis, what do you say? Want to climb the stairs? Would you like to keep your dead son or go for what's behind door number one, door number two, or door number three? Hey-ho, let's go. Turned mean. Only animal. The flesh looked. A man. Yours. His. Lewis dumped the rest of his beer down the sink, feeling suddenly that he was going to vomit. The room was moving around in great swinging motions. There was a knock at the door. For a long time, it seemed like a long time anyway, he believed it was only in his head, a hallucination. But the knocking just went on and on, patient, implacable, and suddenly Lewis found himself thinking of the story of the monkey's paw, and a cold terror slipped into him. He seemed to feel it with total physical reality. It was like a dead hand that had been kept in a refrigerator, a dead hand which had suddenly taken on its own disembodied life and slipped inside his shirt to clutch the flesh over his heart. It was a silly image, fulsome and silly, but oh, it didn't feel silly. No. Lewis went to the door on feet he could not feel and lifted the latch with nerveless fingers. And as he swung it open, he thought, it'll be Pascal. Like they said about Jim Morrison, back from the dead and bigger than ever. Pascal standing there in his jogging shorts, big as life and as moldy as month-old bread. Pascal with his horribly ruined head. Pascal bringing the warning again. Don't go up there. What was that old song by the Animals? Baby, please don't go. Baby, please don't go. You know I love you so. Baby, please don't go. The door swung open. And standing there on his front step in the blowing dark of this midnight, between the day of the funeral parlor visitation and the day of his son's burial, was Judd Crandall. His thin white hair blew randomly in the chilly dark. Lewis tried to laugh. Time seemed to have turned cleverly back on itself. It was Thanksgiving again. Soon they would put the stiff, unnaturally thickened body of Ellie's cat, Winston Churchill, into a plastic garbage bag and start off.
Oh, do not ask what is it. Let us go and make our visit.
Can I come in, Lewis? Judd asked. He took a pack of Chesterfields from his shirt pocket and poked one in his mouth.
Tell you what, Lewis said. It's late and I've been drinking a pile of beer.
Yeah, I could smell it, Judd said.
He struck a match. The wind snuffed it. He struck another around cupped hands, but the hands trembled and betrayed the match to the wind again. He got a third match, prepared to strike it, and then looked up at Lewis standing in the doorway.
I can't get this thing lit, Judd said. Gonna let me in or not, Lewis?
Lewis stepped aside and let Judd walk in. 38. They sat at the kitchen table over beers. First time we've ever tipped one in our kitchen, Lewis thought, a little surprised. Halfway across the living room, Ellie had cried out in her sleep, and both of them had frozen like statues in a children's game. The cry had not been repeated.
Okay, Lewis said. What are you doing over here at 12:15 on the morning my son gets buried? You're a friend, Judd, but this is stretching it.
Judd drank, wiped his mouth with the heel of his hand, and looked directly at Lewis. There was something clear and positive in his eyes, and Lewis at last looked down from it.
You know why I'm here, Judd said. You're thinking about things that are not to be thought of, Lewis. Worse still, I fear you're considering them. I wasn't thinking about anything but going up to bed, Lewis said. I have a burying to go to tomorrow. I'm responsible for more pain in your heart than you should have tonight, Judd said softly. For all I know, I may even have been responsible for the death of your son.
Lewis looked up, startled. What? Judd, don't talk crazy.
You are thinking of trying to put him up there, Judd said. Don't you deny the thought has crossed your mind, Lewis?
Lewis did not reply.
How far does its influence extend? Judd said. Can you tell me that? No, I can't answer that question myself, and I've lived my whole life in this patch of the world. I know about the Micmacs, and that place was always considered to be a kind of holy place to them, but not in a good way. Stanny B. told me that. My father told me, too, later on, after Spot died the second time. Now the Micmacs, the state of Maine, and the government of the United States are arguing in court about who owns that land. Who does own it? No one really knows, Lewis. Not anymore. Different people laid claim to it at one time or another, but no claim ever stuck. Anson Ludlow, the great-grandson of this town's founding father, for one, his claim was maybe the best for a white man, since Joseph Ludlow the Elder had the whole shebang as a grant from good King Georgie, back when Maine was just a big province of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. But even then he would have been in a hell of a court fight because there was cross-claims to the land by other Ludlows, and by a fellow named Peter Dimmitt, who claimed he could prove pretty convincingly that he was a Ludlow on the other side of the sheets. And Joseph Ludlow the Elder was money poor but land rich toward the end of his life, and every now and then he'd just gift somebody with 200 or 400 acres when he got into his cups.
Were none of those deeds recorded? Lewis asked, fascinated in spite of himself.
Oh, they were regular bears for recording deeds, were our grandfathers, Judd said, lighting a new cigarette from the butt of the old one. The original grant on your land goes like this.
Judd closed his eyes and quoted.
From the great old maple which stands atop Quinsbury Ridge to the verge of Orrington Stream, thus runneth the tract from north until south.
Judd grinned without much humor.
But the great old maple fell down in 1882, let's say, and was rotted to moss by the year 1900, and Orrington Stream silted up and turned to marsh in the 10 years between the end of the Great War and the crash of the stock market. A nice mess it made. It ended up not mattering to old Anson anyways. He was struck and killed by lightning in 1921, right up around where that burying ground is.
Lewis stared at Judd. Judd sipped his beer.
It don't matter. There's lots of places where the history of ownership is so tangled it never gets unraveled. Only the lawyers end up making money. Hell, Dickens knew that. I suppose the Indians will get it back in the end, and I think that's the way it should be. But that don't really matter, Lewis. I came over here tonight to tell you about Timmy Baderman and his dad.
Who's Timmy Baderman?
Timmy Baderman was one of the 20 or so boys from Ludlow that went overseas to fight Hitler. He left in 1942. He come back in a box with a flag on the top of it in 1943. He died in Italy. His daddy, Bill Baderman, lived his whole life in this town. He about went crazy when he got the telegram. And then he quieted right down. He knew about the Micmac burying ground, you see. And he decided what he wanted to do.
The chill was back. Lewis stared at Judd for a long time, trying to read the lie in the old man's eyes. It was not there. But the fact of this story surfacing just now was damned convenient. "Why didn't you tell me this the other night?" he said finally. "After we did the cat?"
When I asked you if anyone had ever buried a person up there, you said no one ever had.
Because you didn't need to know, Judd said. Now you do.
Lewis was silent for a long time. Was he the only one?
The only one I know of personally, Judd said gravely. The only one to ever try it? I doubt that, Lewis. I doubt it very much. I'm kind of like the preacher in Ecclesiastes. I don't believe there's anything new under the sun. Oh, sometimes the glitter they sprinkle over the top of a thing changes, but that's all. What's been tried once has been tried once before, and before, and before.
He looked down at his liver-spotted hands. In the living room, the clock softly chimed 12:30.
I decided that a man in your profession is used to looking at symptoms and seeing the diseases underneath. And I decided I had to talk straight to you when Mortensen down at the funeral home told me you'd ordered a grave liner instead of a ceiling vault.
Lewis looked at Judd for a long time, saying nothing. Judd flushed deeply but didn't look away. Finally, Lewis said, "Sounds like maybe you did a little snooping, Judd. I am sorry because of it."
I didn't ask him which you bought. Not right out, maybe.
But Judd did not reply, and although his blush had deepened even more, his complexion was approaching a plum color now. His eyes still didn't waver. At last, Lewis sighed. He felt unutterably tired.
Oh, fuck it, I don't care. Maybe you're even right. Maybe it was on my mind. If it was, it was on the downside of it. I didn't think much about what I was ordering. I was thinking about Gage. I know you were thinking about Gage, but you knew the difference. Your uncle was an undertaker.
Yes, he had known the difference. A ceiling vault was a piece of construction work, something which was meant to last a long, long time. Concrete was poured into a rectangular mold reinforced with steel rods, and then after the graveside services were over, a crane lowered a slightly curved concrete top into place. The lid was sealed with a substance like the hot patch highway departments used to fill potholes. Uncle Carl had told Lewis that sealant, trade named Everlock, got itself a fearsome grip after all that weight had been on it for a while. Uncle Carl, who liked to yarn as much as anyone, at least when he was with his own kind, and Lewis, who had worked with him summers for a while, qualified as a sort of apprentice undertaker, told his nephew of an exhumation order he'd gotten once from the Cook County DA's office. Uncle Carl went out to Groveland to oversee the exhumation. They could be tricky things, he said. People whose only ideas concerning disinterral came from those horror movies starring Boris Karloff as Dr. Frankenstein's monster and Dwight Fry as Igor had an entirely wrong impression. Opening a ceiling vault was no job for two men with picks and shovels, not unless they had about 6 weeks to spend on the job. This one went all right, at first. The grave was opened, and the crane grappled onto the top of the vault. Only the top didn't just pull off as it was supposed to. The whole vault, its concrete sides already a little wet and discolored, started to rise out of the ground instead. Uncle Carl screamed for the crane operator to back off. Uncle Carl wanted to go back to the mortuary and get some stuff that would weaken the sealant's grip a bit. The crane operator either didn't hear or wanted to go for the whole thing, like a little kid playing with a toy crane and junk prizes in a penny arcade. Uncle Carl said that the damn fool almost got it, too. The vault was 3/4 of the way out. Uncle Carl and his assistant could hear water pattering from the underside of the vault onto the floor of the grave. It had been a wet week in Chicagoland, when the crane just tipped over and went kerplunk into the grave. The crane operator crashed into the windshield and broke his nose. That day's festivities cost Cook County roughly $3,000, $2,100 over the usual price of such gay goings-on. The real point of the story for Uncle Carl
was that the crane operator had been elected president of the Chicago local of the Teamsters 6 years later. Graveliners were simpler matters. Such a liner was no more than a humble concrete box, open at the top. It was set into the grave on the morning of a funeral. Following the services, the coffin was lowered into it. The sextons then brought on the top, which was usually in two segments. These segments were lowered vertically into the ends of the grave, where they stood up like bookends. Iron rings were embedded into the concrete at the ends of each segment. The sextons would run lengths of chain through them and lower them gently onto the top of the graveliner. Each section would weigh 60, perhaps 70 pounds, 80 tops, and no sealer was used. It was easy enough for a man to open a graveliner. That's what Judd was implying. Easy enough for a man to disinter the body of his son and bury it someplace else. Shh, shh, we will not speak of such things. These are secret things.
Yes, I guess I knew the difference between a ceiling vault and a graveliner, Lewis said. But I wasn't thinking about what you think I was thinking about.
Lewis, it's late, Lewis said. It's late, I'm drunk, and my heart aches. If you feel like you have to tell me this story, then tell me and let's get it over with. Maybe I should have started with martinis, he thought. Then I could have been safely passed out when he came knocking. All right, Lewis. Thank you. Just go on. Judd paused a moment, thinking, then began to speak.
39. In those days, back during the war, I mean, the train still stopped in Orrington, and Bill Baderman had a funeral hack there at the loading depot to meet the freight carrying the body of his son Timmy. The coffin was unloaded by four railroad men. I was one of them. There was an army fellow on board from Graves and Registration. That was the army's wartime version of Undertakers, Lewis. But he never got off the train. He was sitting drunk in a boxcar that still had 12 coffins in it. We put Timmy into the back of a mortuary Cadillac. In those days, it still wasn't uncommon to hear such things called hurry-up wagons, because in the old days, the major concern was to get them into the ground before they rotted. Bill Baderman stood by, his face stony and kinda, I don't know, kinda dry, I guess you'd say. He wept no tears. Huey Garber was driving the train that day, and he said that army fella had really had a tour for himself. Huey said they'd flown in a whole shitload of those coffins to Limestone and Presque Isle, at which point both the coffins and their keeper entrained for Point South. The army fella comes walking up to Huey, and he takes a fifth of rye whiskey out of his uniform blouse, and he says in this soft, drawly, Dixie voice, "Well, Mr. Engineer, you're driving a mystery train today. Did you know that?" Huey shakes his head. "Well, you are. At least that's what they call a funeral train down in Alabama." Huey says the fella took a list out of his pocket and squinted at it. "We're gonna stop by dropping two of those coffins off in Holton, and then I've got one for Passadumkeg, two for Bangor, one for Derry, one for Ludlow, and so on. I feel like a fucking milkman. You want a drink?" Well, Huey declines a drink on the grounds that the Bangor and Aroostook is pretty fussy on the subject of train drivers with rye on their breaths, and the fella from Graves and Registration don't hold it against Huey, any more than Huey holds the fact of the army fella's drunkenness against him. "They even shook on her," Huey said. So off they go, dropping those flag-covered coffins every other stop or two. 18 or 20 of them in all. Huey said it went all the way to Boston, and there was weeping and wailing relatives at every stop, except Ludlow. And at Ludlow, he was treated to the sight of Bill Baderman, who he said looked like he was dead inside and just waiting for his soul to stink. When he got off that train, he said he woke up that army fella, and they hit some spots, 15 or 20, and Huey got drunker than he had ever been and went to a whore, which he'd never done in his whole life.
and woke up with a set of crabs so big and mean that they gave him the shivers. And he said that if that was what they called a mystery train, he never wanted to drive no mystery train again. Timmy's body was taken up to the Greenspan funeral home on Fern Street. It used to be across from where the new Franklin Laundry stands now. And 2 days later, he was buried in Pleasant View Cemetery with full military honors. Well, I tell you, Lewis, Mrs. Bateman was dead 10 years then, along with the second child she tried to bring into the world, and that had a lot to do with what happened. A second child might have helped to ease the pain, don't you think? A second child might have reminded old Bill that there's others that feel the pain and have to be helped through. I guess in that way you're luckier, having another child and all, I mean. A child and a wife who are both alive and well. According to the letter Bill got from the lieutenant in charge of his boy's platoon, Timmy was shot down on the road to Rome on July 15, 1943. His body was shipped home 2 days later, and it got to Limestone on the 19th. It was put aboard Huey Garber's mystery train the very next day. Most of the GIs who got killed in Europe were buried in Europe, but all of the boys who went home on that train were special. Timmy had died charging a machine gun nest, and he had won the Silver Star, posthumously. Timmy was buried, don't hold me to this, but I think it was on July 22nd. It was 4 or 5 days later that Marjorie Washburn, who was the mail woman in those days, saw Timmy walking up towards York's livery stable. Well, Margie damn near drove right off the road, and you can understand why. She went back to the post office, tossed her leather bag with all her undelivered mail still in it on George Anderson's desk, and told him she was going home and to bed right then. "Margie, are you sick?" George asks. "You are just as white as a gull's wing." "I've had the fright of my life, and I don't want to talk to you about it," Margie Washburn says. "I ain't going to talk to Brian about it, or my mom, or anybody. When I get up to heaven, if Jesus asks me to talk to him about it, maybe I will. But I don't believe it." And out she goes. Everybody knew Timmy was dead. There was his obituary in the Bangor Daily News and the Ellsworth American just the week before, picture and all, and half the town turned out for his funeral up to the city. And here Margie seen him, walking up the road, lurching up the road, she finally told old George Anderson. Only this was 20 years later, and she was dying. And George told me it seemed to him like she wanted to tell somebody what she'd seen. George said it seemed to him like it preyed on her mind, you know. "Pale he was," she said, "and dressed in an old pair of chino pants and a faded flannel hunting shirt, although it must have been 90 degrees in the shade that day. Margie said all his hair was sticking up in the back. His eyes were like raisins stuck in bread dough. I saw a ghost that day, George. That's what scared me so. I never thought I'd see such a thing, but there it was." Well, word got around. Pretty soon some other people saw Timmy, too. Mrs. Stratton, well, we called her Mrs., but so far as anyone knew, she could have been single or divorced or grass-widowed. She had a little two-room house down where the Peterson Road joins the Hancock Road, and she had a lot of jazz records, and sometimes she'd be willing to throw you a little party if you had a $10 bill that wasn't working too hard. Well, she saw him from a porch, and she said he walked right up to the edge of the road and stopped there. "He just stood there," she said, "his hands dangling at his sides and his head pushed forward, looking like a boxer who's ready to eat him some canvas." She said she stood there on a porch, heart going like 60, too scared to move. Then she said he turned around, and it was like watching a drunk man trying to do an about-face. One leg went way out, and the other foot turned, and he just about fell over. She said he looked right at her, and all the strength just run out of her hands, and she dropped the basket of washing she had, and the clothes fell out and got smutty all over again. She said his eyes, she said they looked as dead and dusty as marbles, Lewis. But he saw her, and he grinned, and she said he talked to her. Asked her if she still had those records, because he wouldn't mind cutting a rug with her, maybe that very night. And Mrs. Stratton went back inside, and she wouldn't come out for most of a week, and by then it was over anyway. A lot of people saw Tammy Bateman. Many of them are dead now. Mrs. Stratton is, for one, and others have moved on. But there are a few old crocks like me left around who'll tell you, if you ask them right. We saw him, I tell you, walking back and forth along the Peterson Road, a mile east of his daddy's house and a mile west. Back and forth he went, back and forth all day, and for all anyone knew, all night. Shirt untucked, pale face, hair all stuck up in spikes, fly unzipped sometimes, and this look on his face. This look. Judd paused to light a cigarette, then shook the match out and looked at Lewis through the haze of drifting blue smoke. And although the story was, of course, utterly mad, there was no lie in Judd's eyes. You know, they have these stories and these movies. I don't know if they're true. About zombies down in Haiti. In the movies, they just sort of shamble along, with their dead eyes staring straight ahead, real slow and sort of clumsy. Tammy Bateman was like that, Lewis. Like a zombie in a movie. But he wasn't. There was something more. There was something going on behind his eyes, and sometimes you could see it and sometimes you couldn't see it. Something behind his eyes, Lewis. I don't think that thinking is what I want to call it. I don't know what in the hell I want to call it. It was sly, that was one thing. Like him telling Mrs. Stratton he wanted to cut a rug with her. There was something going on in there, Lewis, but I don't think it was thinking, and I don't think it had much. Maybe nothing at all to do with Tammy Bateman. It was more like a radio signal that was coming from somewhere else. You looked at him and you thought, if he touches me, I'm gonna scream. Like that. Back and forth he went, up and down the road. And one day after I got home from work, this must have been, oh, I'm gonna say it was July 30th or so. Here is George Anderson, the postmaster, don't you know? Sitting on my back porch drinking iced tea with Hannibal Benson, who was then our second selectman, and Alan Purinton, who was fire chief. Norma sat there too, but never said a thing. George kept rubbing the stump at the top of his right leg. Lost most of that leg working on the railroad, he did, and the stump used to bother him something fierce on those hot and muggy days. But here he was, misery or not. This has gone far enough, George says to me. I got a mail woman who won't deliver out on the Peterson Road. That's one thing. It's starting to raise Cain with the government, and that's something else. What do you mean it's raising Cain with the government? I asked. Hannibal said he'd had a call from the War Department. Some lieutenant named Kinsman, whose job it was to sort out malicious mischief from plain old tomfoolery. Four or five people have written anonymous letters to the War Department, Hannibal says, and this Lieutenant Kinsman is starting to get a little bit concerned. If it was just one fellow who had written one letter, they'd laugh it off. If it was just one fellow writing a whole bunch of letters, Kinsman says he'd call the state police up in Derry Barracks and tell them they might have a psychopath with a hate on against the Bateman family in Ludlow. But these letters all came from different people. He said you could tell that by the handwriting, name or no name, and they all say the same crazy thing, that if Timothy Bateman is dead, he makes one hell of a lively corpse walking up and down Peterson Road with his bare face hanging out. This Kinsman is gonna send a fellow out or come himself if this don't settle down, Hannibal finishes up. They want to know if Timmy's dead, or AWOL, or what, because they don't like to think their records are all sixes and sevens. Also, they're gonna want to know who was buried in Tammy Bateman's box if he wasn't. Well, you can see what kind of a mess it was, Lewis. We sat there most of an hour, drinking iced tea and talking it over. Norma asked if we wanted sandwiches, but no one did. We talked it around and talked it around, and finally we decided we had to go out there to the Bateman place. I'll never forget that night. Not if I live to be twice as old as I am now. It was hot, hotter than the hinges of hell, with the sun going down like a bucket of guts behind the clouds. There was none of us wanted to go, but we had to. Norma knew it before any of us. She got me inside on some pretext or other and said, "Don't you let them dither around and put this off, Judson. You gotta get this taken care of. It's an abomination." Judd measured Lewis evenly with his eyes. That was what she called it, Lewis. It was her word. Abomination. And she kind of whispers in my ear, "If anything happens, Judd, you just run. Never mind these others, they'll have to look out for themselves. You remember me and bust your hump right out of there if anything happens." We drove over in Hannibal Benson's car. That son of a bitch got all the A coupons he wanted, I don't know how. Nobody said much, but all four of us were smoking like chimbleys. We were scared, Lewis, just as scared as we could be. But the only one who really said anything was Alan Purinton. He says to George, "Bill Bateman has been up to Dickens in that woods north of Route 15, and I'll put my warrant to that." Nobody answered, but I remember George nodding his head. Well, we got there, and Alan knocked, but nobody answered, so we went around to the back, and there the two of them were. Bill Bateman was sitting there on his back stoop with a pitcher of beer, and Timmy was at the back of the yard, just staring up at that red, bloody sun as it went down. His whole face was orange with it, like he'd been flayed alive. And Bill, he looked like the devil had gotten him after his 7 years of highfalutin. He was floating in his clothes, and I judged he'd lost 40 pounds. His eyes had gone back in their sockets until they were like little animals in a pair of caves. And his mouth kept going tick, tick, tick on the left side. Judd paused, seemed to consider, and then nodded imperceptibly. Lewis, he looked damned. Timmy looked around at us and grinned. Just seeing him grin made you want to scream. Then he turned and went back to looking at the sun go down. Bill says, "I didn't hear you boys knock," which was a bald-faced lie, of course, since Alan laid on that door loud enough to wake up a deaf man. No one seemed like they was going to say anything, so I says, "Bill, I heard your boy was killed over in Italy." "That was a mistake," he says, looking right at me.
"Was it?" I says.
"You see him standing right there, don't you?" he says.
"So who do you reckon was in that coffin you had buried out at Pleasant View?" Alan Purinton asks him.
"Be damned if I know," Bill says, "and be damned if I care."
He goes to get a cigarette and spills them all over the back porch, then breaks two or three trying to pick them up.
"Probably have to be an exhumation," Hannibal says. "You know that, don't you? I had a call from the goddamn War Department, Bill. They are going to want to know if they buried some other mother's son under Timmy's name."
"Well, what in the hell of it?" Bill says in a loud voice. "That's nothing to me, is it? I got my boy. Timmy come home the other day. He's been shell-shocked or something. He's a little strange now, but he'll come around."
"Let's quit this, Bill," I says, and all at once I was pretty mad at him. "If and when they dig up that army coffin, they're gonna find it dead empty, unless you went to the trouble of filling it up with rocks after you took your boy out of it. And I don't think you did. I know what happened. Hannibal and George and Alan here know what happened. And you know what happened, too. You've been fooling around up in the woods, Bill, and you have caused yourself and this town a lot of trouble."
"You fellas know your way out, I guess," he says. "I don't have to explain myself to you or justify myself to you or nothing. When I got that telegram, the life ran right out of me. I felt to go just like piss down the inside of my leg. Well, I got my boy back. They had no right to take my boy. He was only 17. He was all I had left of his dear mother. And it was ill-fucking-legal. So fuck the Army and fuck the War Department and fuck the United States of America. And fuck you boys, too." I got him back. He'll come around. And that's all I gotta say. Now you all just march your boots back where you came from. And his mouth is tick, tick, ticking, and there's sweat all over his forehead in big drops.